Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Administrative Law and Regulation and Environmental and Energy Law Practice Groups, was recorded on Thursday, March 15, 2018, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is a review of Administrator Pruitt's first year at the EPA. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have moderating discussion Adam Gustafson, who is a partner at Boyd & Gray & Associates. Our moderator will begin by introducing our speakers, laying out the subject of today's call, and then we'll pass the baton with a series of questions to begin the discussion today. At the end of our call, we will have an audience Q&A, so as our speakers are speaking with each other, please keep note of what you'd like to ask them. There will be plenty of time for your questions. So thank you again for speaking with us today. Adam, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Wes. It's been 1 year since Scott Pruitt was appointed administrator of EPA, and before that, he was Attorney General of Oklahoma. In that capacity, Pruitt was involved in several challenges to EPA regulations that he saw as federal overreaching. Some welcomed Pruitt's nomination as a much-needed antidote to an overweening federal bureaucracy. Others complained that President Trump was putting the fox in charge of the henhouse. Today, we're pleased to have two EPA veterans with us today to evaluate Administrator Pruitt's first year at the agency. Jeff Holmstead is a partner at Bracewell, where he's involved in environmental litigation. He served as assistant administrator for the Office of Air and Radiation between 2001 and 2005. Our second speaker is John Walk. He is director of the Natural Resources Defense Council's Clean Air Project and its Climate and Clean Air Program. So thank you both for being with us today. From the beginning, Administrator Pruitt has talked about taking EPA back to basics. He's described three goals of the back to basics agenda. The first is to refocus on EPA's core mission of clean air, land, and water. The second, to return power to the states. And the third, to restore the rule of law and implement fair process. So let's take each of those three goals in turn. And my first question is for you, Jeff Holmstead. In what sense did Administrator Pruitt understand EPA to have lost sight of its core mission, that core mission of air, water, and land quality? And what has he done to restore that core mission? Has he succeeded, in your view?
Thanks, Adam. Let me start by making a point that I think will inform much of what I have to say. I think it's hard to understand Scott Pruitt's agenda and priorities without understanding what had happened at EPA during the prior 8 years. Regardless of whether you think it's a good thing or bad thing, you'd have to say that the Obama EPA was remarkably productive when it came to issuing rules and new major rules, and much of the focus of the Obama EPA was on climate change, trying to use the Clean Air Act to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases. And most famously, of course, is the Clean Power Plan, but also there was a number of other things. And so this focus on climate change and reducing greenhouse gases had become the number one priority of the Obama EPA, which is not to say they weren't active in other areas. And so I think when the administrator talks about going back to basics, he really means, we're no longer going to be trying to invent new ways to use our statutory authority to go after things that were really not intended, and we're going to focus instead on sort of the basic mission, which is air quality and water quality and cleaning up landfills and Superfund sites and things like that.
Thanks, Jeff. Oh, I'm sorry. Please continue.
No. That's probably enough of an answer for now. I suspect that we'll have a chance to talk about some of the specifics as we go forward.
Well, that's a great starting point. John Walk, what is your response to Jeff's characterization of the past 8 years, and is a back to basics agenda even necessary here?
Well, I think Jeff is right in the following sense. The Pruitt tenure has clearly been a reaction against the Obama administration that continued the litigation path he had joined with industry to challenge the Obama administration in court. Let's note that of 14 lawsuits he brought as Attorney General, none of them succeeded in overturning a single EPA rule. Now, with power in his hands at EPA, he is focused single-mindedly on a deregulatory agenda, rolling back clean air, clean water, and land protections. Back to basics is, I think, a coded, veiled reference to not pursuing CO2, which is very much a pollutant that EPA must regulate under Supreme Court case law. And the other elements of his back to basics agenda are nice political rhetoric about cooperative federalism and the rule of law that is really masking a concerted rollback strategy. He is interested in returning power to the states to deregulate, but not to California to regulate more. And as far as rule of law goes, I think it's important to note at the outset of this call that Scott Pruitt has lost more lawsuits in his first year as EPA administrator than any EPA administrator that preceded him. And it was the result of a lot of clumsiness in trying to stop the effective dates or thwart or repeal rules without going through proper APA rulemakings and other things. And I think it wasted their first year. And the second year, I think they will have learned that lesson, but it will still be single-mindedly focused on deregulation.
I do want to get to rule of law, but for the moment, let's stick with this idea of returning to EPA's core mission. John, you brought up the Clean Power Plan. I think there are other items on Pruitt's agenda that he would also point to as returning to EPA's core mission. In his public speaking, he spent a lot of time talking about Superfund cleanup, and the agency just issued a report that projects that by the end of 2018, 20 Superfund sites will be removed from the Superfund registry. Jeff, do you have thoughts about these other efforts to return to the core competencies of the agency?
I don't spend a lot of my time focused on Superfund issues, but I think anybody who does would say that there are a number of these sites that have been sort of almost in limbo for many, many years. And that's in many cases because there's controversy over exactly, you know, how they should be cleaned up and how much they should be cleaned up. And I think, again, whether you think his decisions have been wise or not, you have to give him credit for trying to just make some of those hard decisions and move forward. I will note that in a few cases, he has supported remedies, cleanup remedies, that are much more expensive than had been on the table before. And I'm not sure those are justified, but he certainly has walked the walk when it comes to trying to speed up Superfund cleanup decisions. So I think at least in that case, you would have to say, you know, he is doing something that he said he would do. The other thing in terms of back to basics, you know, he will also talk, I think, a fair bit about, you know, what happened in Flint, Michigan, and the need for EPA to focus on drinking water. And, you know, that was, I think, if not a tragedy, certainly, you know, a difficult situation for a lot of people who are not aware that they were ingesting lead. And EPA has used its funding authority, I think, to give about $350 million to Michigan to help with the improvements in their drinking water system. And I think they're looking at other places around the country where they can, you know, really focus on making sure that drinking water is clean.
That's a good point. John, what is NRDC's take on the so-called war on lead and Pruitt's effort to help states in their own efforts to promote safe drinking water?
Well, it's encouraging talk so far. It does allow the administrator to point to Congress and the purse as the ultimate solution and therefore deflect attention from what he can do with his regulatory powers. But we understand that they're pursuing a rulemaking, and the jury's still out on what it will say. I will note that talk is a defining theme of his tenure so far. Mr. Pruitt has not taken a significant action to reduce air or water pollution during the time he has been in office, nor even announced initiatives that would do so. Instead, his focus, again, has been single-mindedly on deregulatory rollbacks in the form of recent guidance documents, rulemakings to block the effective date or extend the compliance dates of rules, or proposals or final rules to repeal rules. In their own end-of-year report, they identified 22 deregulatory actions they claimed could save $1 billion without backing that figure up remotely. But when it came down to identifying the things they were actually doing to carry out his own rhetoric of air, water, and land improvements, the document was just vapid. It was empty. There was one item identified for air pollution, and that was approving state plans. Well, let me tell you two dirty little secrets about that. The first is that those were rules that states had adopted themselves. All EPA was being asked to do was approve or disapprove them. The second thing to note is that many of the approvals were approving backsliding that had been languishing because the Obama administration was refusing to approve those things, or instances of EPA overturning federal plans that accomplished deeper reductions. So by their own measures, they are unable to identify a positive clean air or clean water agenda that actually gives content to the back to basics rhetoric.
Well, I think, John, you've helped us turn to the second of the two of the three prongs of Pruitt's back to basics agenda, and that is his effort to return power to the states. As you point out, by withdrawing federal implementation plans, EPA reverts to state implementation plans. In other words, state regulation in an effort to attain the federal ambient air quality standards. And the statutes that EPA administers have always been built on that model of cooperative federalism. There was a sense among some conservatives that in recent years the agency had lost sight of the role of states in environmental protection. And one of the prime examples that people pointed to of that was EPA's Waters of the United States rule, in which the past administration interpreted the phrase Waters of the United States to embrace a great deal of land that sometimes wasn't even wet year-round. Administrator Pruitt has proposed to rescind that rule and to redefine the phrase consistent with the statute. John, do you think that the last administration's rule went too far? And what is your take on Administrator Pruitt's response?
Well, we do not think it went too far. EPA was faced with the unenviable task of trying to reconcile some competing and arguably conflicting case law, including Supreme Court jurisprudence, and I don't envy them the task. They built an incredibly extensive record of hydrology evidence and other studies that I think it's going to be difficult, if not impossible, for the current administration to overturn in carrying out what is clearly a result-oriented enterprise. But the administration, Pruitt, unfortunately, has a habit of sliding into flat-out mischaracterizations of waters that would have been covered under the prior rule. He has a thing about consistently claiming that, you know, ditches and other things that the rule quite explicitly says are not covered would in fact be covered. So he wants to scale back coverage of waters protected by the Clean Water Act, and we'll see if he is successful or not. But it's just not possible to claim that this is dedicated to a real core mission of the agency to protect water pollution. Up to one third of the waters from which Americans get drinking supplies are going to be adversely affected by his withdrawal of the Clean Water Rule. And one can disagree about the law or even that outcome, but it's really not plausible to claim that he is effectively protecting clean water as much as the prior administration was attempting to do with this rule.
Jeff, what is your take on the Waters of the United States rule and more broadly on Administrator Pruitt's effort to restore cooperative federalism?
Well, you know, let me answer that by making an observation that I think is important for all of these issues. You know, implicit in John's comments are that the only job of the EPA administrator is to continue to impose new regulations that will, you know, continue to do what John wants to do in terms of reducing, expanding federal oversight over waters, making it more difficult for people to develop projects. And one of the things that I will say that I admire about the administrator is he really is the first administrator in my professional career who has said that an important priority is regulatory reform. And, you know, we've had many years, and especially over the last years, of very aggressive regulation. And I think it's important that we have someone who is really willing to step back and say, look at the regulatory landscape, and some of the things that have been done are either unjustifiable legally or just unnecessarily burdensome. And so I think, you know, John is correct in saying that at least one focus has been on deregulatory efforts, but I wouldn't characterize as rollbacks. I would say that in many cases, that they're just making these regulatory programs work better. And we can get into some examples, but I will say this. At the end of Mr. President Trump's first term, air quality will be better throughout the United States. Water quality will be better throughout the United States. More land will be cleaned up. And that's largely because of all the other programs that are continuing to roll forward as a result of efforts by many prior administrations. So we are continuing to make progress because of the basic structure of our laws, and what the administrator is doing is in many ways is simply trying to reduce unnecessarily regulatory burdens so that we can make that progress in a cost-effective manner. When it comes to cooperative federalism, again, under the Obama administration, EPA imposed its will on states more times than all other prior administrations combined. When you look at these state implementation plans that had been submitted to EPA for approval, under many different administrations for many years, there was an acknowledgement that this was a cooperative relationship, that EPA's job was not to substitute its judgment for the judgment of states when the states have been given discretion. And yet under the Obama administration, over and over again, we had EPA coming in and imposing much more expensive, much more burdensome federal implementation plans, where the states had really been given authority to determine how far they should go and on what timetable. And this is especially true in the regional haze program. So I think it's absolutely clear that by respecting the role that states are given under these statutes, the administrator really is returning EPA to its historic role of being a co-regulator, not being, this federal presence that dictates its will to each and every one of the states.
Jeff, some states have, of course, opposed Pruitt's efforts, and one of those states is California. One of the first actions that Pruitt took as administrator was a joint action with Transportation Secretary Chao to reopen a midterm evaluation of the greenhouse gas and fuel economy standards for new vehicles. EPA's final determination of the appropriateness of the greenhouse gas standard is due in just a couple weeks, April 1. But California has criticized this action because that state perceives it as a threat to California's efforts to make standards more stringent for new vehicles. So, in your view, how should an administrator who's concerned with cooperative federalism evaluate California's concerns?
So, again, I think in some ways it's a red herring to talk about federalism in this context. When the Clean Air Act was adopted back in 1970, there was an acknowledgement that there were some products that were sold nationwide, and key among those were cars and trucks, that those were produced largely in and around Detroit and other parts of the country, but they were sold throughout the nation, and that if each state was given authority to regulate cars that were registered or sold in its state, it would impose a real burden on companies located elsewhere and would make the whole process much more cumbersome and difficult. So there was this basic decision that EPA would regulate cars and trucks, and that wouldn't be given to the states. The exception was California, which in my mind was given constitutionally suspect special preference, and given this authority that was explicitly denied all other states, for California to regulate cars and trucks sold there because of the extraordinary air pollution problems that California was facing. And it's even true today, although the climate has been remarkable, but even today, California has the most serious PM2.5 and ozone problems. And so at least there was a rationale for giving California this authority. Now California has tried to use that authority to deal with climate change, to deal with greenhouse gas emissions. And there is nothing at all unique to California when it comes to those. And yet California is saying, well, we want to be able to have our own regulations to deal with climate change, to deal with greenhouse gas emissions, even though that was never the intention of this special preference given to California. So I think we don't know what's going to happen with this midterm evaluation. The Obama administration, again, imposed what are called CAFE standards or CO2 emission standards that were pretty reasonable in the early years, but then became much more stringent in the later years. And so what EPA is now going through of a process is saying, you know, what was imposed back in 2011 or 2012 for 2022 to 2025, is that really feasible and cost effective in light of where we are now, and in light of the fact that consumers have not shown a great interest in buying more expensive electric vehicles and hybrids and other things? And so we're in the middle of that process, but again, in some ways, that whole issue is set up by the fact that there were these very aggressive standards that were put in place that were intentionally designed to become aggressive and impose costs far out into the future, as opposed to in the near term when they were established.
John, I'm interested to hear your response to what Jeff's said about cooperative federalism and also about this midterm evaluation of the greenhouse gas standard. Why should California be treated differently from other states when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles?
Well, the short answer is because Clean Air Act says so. And I trust that California and other blue states will just be simply delighted to hear that Jeff Homestead believes their interest in cooperative federalism and their stake in this issue is a red herring and constitutionally suspect. The truth is that when the Bush administration approved California's role to have stricter greenhouse gas standards. That did happen, and it happened over the objection of a certain individual named Bill Wareham, whose emails revealed that he was opposed to it at the time. Well, of course, Mr. Wareham is now the head of the Air Office in the Trump administration, and Mr. Pruitt is carrying out his particular hypocritical version of cooperative federalism, which fuels a race to the bottom, but does not allow a role preserved for California and the follow-on states in the vehicles program to assert their interest in cooperative federalism. It's a one-way ratchet. It's designed to allow increases in pollution, and it's not coincidentally in line with what the automakers are urging this very pro-business administration to do. But it's not even-handed, and it is not remotely a reflection of honest cooperative federalism, which is reflected in the Clean Air Act.
Well, in the interest of time, I think we should turn to the third of the three goals of Pruitt's Back to Basics agenda, and that is the rule of law and process issues, that some of which we've already talked a little bit about. John, one phrase that the administrator uses frequently is regulatory certainty, and I'd like to hear your views on that. Is regulatory certainty ever possible, given that federal rules are always subject to change? And in your view, have EPA's actions in this first year of the Trump administration promoted regulatory certainty?
Well, regulatory certainty is a fine goal, and the government should provide it. I listen to Mr. Pruitt's public speeches carefully and regularly, however, and if you listen in context, regulatory certainty, as he uses it, is synonymous with deregulation and rollbacks. I encourage you to go look at the specific passages, because few object to the neutral concept of regulatory uncertainty. I would submit, however, that he is doing the exact opposite of that. As I mentioned, having lost more lawsuits in his first year than any prior administrator, he has done anything but provide regulatory certainty to industry, because his unlawful extensions and delays in compliance dates and attempt to overturn rules are being rebuffed by the courts. I think that's only going to accelerate in the next 2 years as they get away from a procedural APA-focused law-breaking agenda, if you will, into one that is actually violating the substantive provisions of the statute. So I just don't think that with an agenda of such regular law-breaking, followed by the near certainty that a friendlier administration will reverse essentially all of the guidance documents and very many, if not most, of the regulatory rollbacks without statutory authority changing at bottom. I just don't think it's credible to assign real value to his claims of providing regulatory certainty.
Well, one of the, or some of the efforts that I think EPA has put in this category include efforts to take care of some backlogs that had built up during the past administration, including, I think Jeff mentioned, some state implementation plans that had been sitting on the shelf for a long time. And there are other matters like Toxic Substances Control Act, chemical reviews that had not taken place, and the agency has taken other efforts to streamline new source review permitting, and to reform the agency's sue and settle practice to put more litigation in the public view, so that these court-ordered consent decrees don't just happen without an opportunity for public comment. Jeff, do you have a response to any of John's statements?
So, you know, I don't know if John is correct that they've had that Mr. Pruitt had more adverse decisions and lawsuits than any prior administrator in his first year. I haven't gone back and looked, but I will say that they did make some early missteps, and I think that was because the administration was very slow in getting people in place. We've only had a general counsel in place for a couple months now, and the head of the air office for about the same amount of time. So it did take the Trump administration a long time to get key people in place in these positions. And I think that now that they have a full team or close to a full team, you will see them being much more careful about how they proceed on a number of fronts. I also have to, and I think John will probably agree with this, I think the administrator came in with an undue view of EPA career staff and was not always entirely eager to seek their advice on some of these issues. And I'll say this about the career folks that I have dealt with over the years. You know, I was a political appointee at EPA under the Bush administration, and I felt like most of the staff, especially the senior staff, was just as diligent in trying to implement my policies and our priorities as they were under the Obama administration. And I think you see the same people who now believe that their role is to help implement the decisions and to make sure they're done in a thoughtful, legally defensible way. And I think Mr. Pruitt has learned that lesson, that he does need to rely on the experts at EPA and that they will help him accomplish his goals in a way that is legally defensible. I do think that's important for regulatory certainty. And I think the business community has in some cases maybe tempered the deregulatory instincts of the administration by saying, you know, we would be better off with reasonable regulations that will be durable as opposed to, you know, some regulatory reforms that might be viewed as going too far. So I think this whole issue of regulatory certainty is a tricky one. I will say that we really haven't seen a lot of you know, sort of changes from one administration to the next until, again, we got to the Obama administration. You know, when I joined EPA in 2001, after the Clinton administration, there were certainly a few decisions made by the prior administration that we probably would not have made. But for a variety of reasons, we didn't go back and try to change them. But again, what we saw at the beginning of the Obama administration was an effort to, you know, sort of make a wholesale changes to a lot of things that have been done in the Bush administration, and now you're seeing the same thing happen under Pruitt. I think that we would probably all be better off if we went back to a model where we have a less aggressive sort of swinging of the pendulum back and forth.
John, you also served in EPA in the Office of General Counsel. How do you perceive that the legal issues that EPA faces today are different from the legal issues that you faced when you were there?
Well, we face kind of ordinary challenging legal issues under the Clinton administration, and I think Jeff did as well when he was there. You know, I do want to pay Jeff a compliment, though, because I commend the mature approach he brought to relationship with career staff, including the general counsel's office. I commend a distaste that he showed for guidance documents, and I commend a first term in the first 4 years when he was there, in which the agency did accomplish a lot to reduce air pollution from its diesel program to the cross-state air pollution rule. I mention all that because it serves in such sharp contrast with the current administration. They are proceeding at a frenzied pace to issue guidance documents, which Jeff, by and large, did not. I cannot identify a single meaningful initiative by Mr. Pruitt or Mr. Wareham to reduce air pollution significantly or save lives or avoid asthma attacks. So before the end of the call, I would love Jeff to identify his top contender for me that he thinks is going to achieve the most in those by those metrics based on what the administration has said so far. And then, as you know, as far as the court record goes, I do have to tweak Jeff on one issue historically. The sad truth is that the Obama administration air program inherited more remands and vacatures of EPA clean air rules from the D.C. Circuit than I would be willing to bet any administration before that. And so if you look at the first 4 years of the Obama administration focused on air pollution, they were cleaning up a lot of messes in the air toxics program, the cross-state air pollution rule, the clean air mercury rule that was overturned in court, the PM2.5 standards that were overturned in court. And then the second term was dealing with the mess left behind over the refusal to regulate CO2 in Massachusetts versus EPA. So it is true that we do have these swings. These swings are informed by adverse court decisions. And I'm afraid that this administration is setting itself up in not just the same pattern, but a worse one of violating the law such that the next administration is also going to have to clean up this mess.
Well, I'd like to hear Jeff's response too, but one counterexample that comes to mind is the 2015 Ozone National Ambient Air Quality Standard, which when it was promulgated by the Obama administration was extraordinarily controversial in the business community, and there were loud calls for its repeal, and for a little while it looked like the new EPA might actually try to repeal that, but now that seems not to be the case. It seems that maybe in the interest of maintaining that regulatory certainty, it looks like EPA is on course to finalize non-attainment designations with that new, more stringent ozone standard from the last administration. And I guess my question for John is, is there some point at which we declare victory? Is there... surely you wouldn't say that any possible improvement in environmental quality is worth doing no matter the cost.
No, certainly not. Certainly I would not claim that. I think you do need to look at the costs and the benefits. The court says so. The Office of Management and Budget Guidance says so. I'd love for the Trump administration, to start doing that. When they issued this report that said they could save $1 billion in compliance costs from deregulation, they notably failed to identify how many net benefits would be lost. And I've gone back and looked at many of those regulatory impact analyses, and there would be greater net benefits loss. The ozone is an interesting example. I had to sue them twice to make those non-attainment designations, and they are now doing so 6 months late under threat of not one but two lawsuits. I agree they are providing regulatory certainty by keeping the ozone standards in place, but they were kicking and screaming opposing that, following through with Scott Pruitt's lawsuit against the standards from the beginning, leaving the process in great uncertainty. I frankly think that after Bill Wareham got into office, when you look at the ozone science, it was just insurmountable. They wouldn't stand a chance of overturning the standard through a subsequent rulemaking, just as they failed to justify a PM2.5 standard that departed from the scientific consensus in the Bush administration. So there were clearly some calculations occurring there, and I commend their decision to leave it in place, but it's important to note the history of how we got here.
Before I go to my last question, Jeff, do you have any response you'd like to offer?
You know, I would again point out that certainly the implication of what John says is that it is the job of every new administration to simply add to the regulatory burden that exists today, and that the only way to judge an administration is by, you know, the number of new rules it issues that go beyond what the prior administration did. That's not the way our environmental rules are designed to work. They're designed to solve problems in the most cost-effective way, and I commend the administrator and the other appointees at EPA who are taking a look at a lot of these programs and saying, have they gone too far, and are we achieving our environmental goals in the most cost-effective way possible? And so I think part of the disagreement that you're hearing between John and me is we just have a fundamental difference, different view of what EPA is supposed to do under the laws that it administers. It is not supposed to continually add new regulatory burdens. It is supposed to accomplish regulatory and environmental objectives in the ways designed by Congress and in the most cost-effective ways. And I think that has been a large part of the focus of the Pruitt EPA. I also want to just maybe correct an impression that John may have left. He said earlier on that Mr. Pruitt had brought all these lawsuits and he had lost all of them. I don't know about all 14, but I do know that he was involved in both the Clean Power Plan litigation and the Waters of the United States litigation. Courts had not reached final decisions on those rules, which I think were clear regulatory overreach, but in both cases, the courts had stepped in to stay the rules, to put them on hold, which means, as I think the lawyers on the phone know, that the courts believed that there was a substantial likelihood that, in fact, there had been regulatory overreach. So, you know, Waters of the United States, the Clean Power Plan, those were stayed by the courts, and what Pruitt is doing, I think, is looking at those rules and in both cases, coming up with replacement rules that are respectful of the limitations that Congress placed on EPA.
Before we turn to audience questions, I'd like to ask each of you for your response to one last question, and that is, yesterday we heard a recurring rumor that Trump might nominate Scott Pruitt to be Attorney General. If that were to happen, hypothetically, what should the president look for in a new EPA administrator? And whether Pruitt stays or goes, what do you think the agency's priorities will look like by the end of the administration, and how are they likely to evolve over the next few years? John?
Well, in the hypothetical realm only, I would hope for an EPA administrator committed to reducing air pollution and water pollution and the health toll from that pollution using the statutory tools available to her or him. Mr. Pruitt is clearly not suited for that role and is in fact carrying out his responsibility to fuel the rollback of those statutory tools. So if the president were looking for credentials, those would be mine. I will say, however, that now that the assistant administrators have been installed, including the very savvy lawyer Bill Wareham, Mr. Holmstead's former law partner, I don't think it's going to matter much because I do think that Mr. Wareham in particular has come in with a deregulatory agenda, which he has been carrying out cheerfully since taking office 5 months ago with three or four deregulatory actions just in that span of time, and two or three times that many teed up for further adoption in the next 12 to 14 months. I think in a way it's almost immaterial who the administrator is. She may continue to roam the country giving speeches, but the real deregulatory work is being carried out in the Office of Air and Radiation and other program offices.
Jeff?
Again, I find myself in the uncomfortable position of agreeing with John on some of this. I think that even if Mr. Pruitt were to become the Attorney General, and I have no reason to believe those rumors are true, but even if that were to happen, I think they now have good people in place as the heads of the various offices, and again, especially Bill Wareham in the Office of Air and Radiation, where many of these big issues reside. And I think that it's especially good to have not only Bill, but some of the other assistant administrators who really have been living with these issues for many years, who understand the Administrative Procedures Act, who understand the underlying statutes. And I do believe that they will continue to make important regulatory reforms while at the same time ensuring that air quality continues to improve, water quality continues to improve. We will see that over the next 4 years and well beyond because of the basic programs that are in place. And I think it's a breath of fresh air that we finally have people in place who are willing and able to address some of the regulatory problems that have existed for many years. I wouldn't be surprised if Bill Wareham were the next EPA administrator, if it turns out that Mr. Pruitt decides to leave or is appointed elsewhere. But someone who has some real experience, and I think also someone who can help explain the priorities of the administration when it comes to, you know, continuing to improve air and water quality while doing so in a way that is respectful of the law and respectful of the role that states are given under the various statutes.
Thank you, Jeff Homestead, and thank you, John Walk, for a very insightful, thought-provoking conversation. I'm now going to turn it over to Wes for questions from the audience.
Wonderful. Well, let's go to audience questions then. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor with your question, just enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer all questions in the order in which they are received. Again, if you'd like to ask a question for our speakers, please enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. There are no immediate inputs in the queue. Again, we have plenty of time today, last 15 minutes, in case you'd like to ask anything for our speakers.
One last question while we're waiting for a question from the audience, and that is about sue and settle reform. The Obama administration was criticized for getting a lot of its environmental programs in place, not through ordinary notice and comment rulemaking, but through consent decrees brought about by interest group litigation. And in this new administration, Scott Pruitt has installed a new policy that will avoid that kind of backdoor dealing and invite more public participation in the settlement process when it's appropriate. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on how that will change environmental litigation, if at all, given that both of you have been so involved in EPA litigation now and in the past. Jeff, do you have any thoughts about that?
Yes. You know, what I would say is that there are real problems that Congress should fix in some of these statutes, because the reason that sue and settle has become a practice and has become an issue is these environmental statutes are full of deadlines that are really not practical for the agency to meet. You know, one example is these air quality standards, which are by statute supposed to be reviewed every 5 years. No administration has ever been able to do that, just because of the time and the effort that's involved in those reviews. And so as a result, EPA does not meet those that 5-year cycle, and outside groups are able to dictate EPA's priorities and establish deadlines by suing them for missing deadlines, and the agency essentially has no defense because it didn't meet the deadline. And then the question is, well, you know, what a settlement will be in terms of when the agency will will agree to take some sort of action. I do think it's important that Mr. Pruitt has made it clear that all stakeholders, people within who will be affected by that deadline, will now have an ability to be involved in the discussions over what the deadline should be. Again, you'll still have sue and settle, but hopefully that process will be informed by more than just the environmental community working with EPA staff while, you know, refusing any role for states for affected industry. So I do think that's an important reform, but I think the reason we have this problem is because we have unrealistic deadlines for at least some of the actions that are required under various federal statutes.
John, how will EPA's new policy affect NRDC's litigation strategy?
Well, let me be very clear. Sue and settle is a fraudulent charge. I have challenged Trump administration officials at EPA and the Justice Department repeatedly and publicly to identify a single inappropriate settlement or consent decree by any prior administration involving EPA that skirted notice and public comment rulemaking following the settlement, or that skirted public comment on the consent decree where required by laws like the Clean Air Act. They have been unable to identify a single example. It is a political bumper sticker, and it is not versed in any facts or evidence. Now, Jeff pivots to what may be an issue involving statutory deadlines, but that is not the political charge or the legal charge that is made. If you look at Scott Pruitt's policy, it does something very different and very imbalanced. It instructs EPA and the Justice Department not to settle cases in which environmental groups are plaintiffs without first seeking the permission of states or industry. Now, there is the ability to disregard the failure to grant permission, but there is nothing in the policy that is even-handed and requires any portion of the public to be consulted before settling a case with EPA and industry. We are still settling cases with EPA. The Sierra Club settled a case with EPA last week. So what is the import? The import is that the political bumper sticker is being ignored, as it must, by the EPA and Justice Department attorneys who are continuing to settle cases where settlement is warranted by the facts and the law.
Wes, do we have any questions from the audience?
I'm afraid not. So if anyone would like to ask any questions before we end today, just enter the star key and then the pound key on your phone. I do want
well, this
to.
This is Jeff.
Let me
just say that I choose to interpret the lack of questions as meaning that we provided comprehensive information on everything. Not that there's a lack of interest in these issues. So, given the way I choose to understand the lack of questions, I'm okay with it.
Jeff, I think it means that our audience agrees with both of you 100%.
Well, that's certainly my take as well. I do want to let everyone know that our next telephone call is scheduled for March 21st, and it's going to be a Courthouse Steps discussion on the National Institute of Family and Life Advocates, or NIFLA. So be sure to keep an eye out for that telephone and for all of our upcoming telephone. I may have mentioned at the beginning of this call that this call is being recorded and it'll be turned into a podcast. So you can download that on iTunes and Google Play in the near future. One last call for any audience questions. Just enter the star key, then the pound key. Seeing none, Adam, is there anything else that you'd like to ask our speakers today?
No, I'd welcome any final thoughts from either speaker, but Wes, thank you for having us, and thank you both for an enlightening conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Adam, and thank you to the Federalist Society.
Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I would like to thank our speakers for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us today. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.